Welcome back to another episode of EP Architalk. Just a reminder, if you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review so you help other emerging professionals find us. We're available anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Talisha Sainville, and today we will be speaking to Kelly Hayes McAloney, FAIA, Architect and Director of Campus Planning at the University at Buffalo. Lori Brown, FAIA, Syracuse University Professor and Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and Despina Stratigakos, Architectural Historian at the University at Buffalo and Vice Provost for Inclusion Excellence. Thank you, ladies, for being here. These three architectural scholars and practitioners are working to bring the hidden stories of women in architecture to life. They will share the challenges they faced writing biographies of women architects because of how they were marginalized in the profession for decades. So let's get started. Why don't we start with you, Kelly? Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to architecture?
Great. Thank you so much, Talisha. I really appreciate you having us here. I've wanted to be an architect since I was a child. So my dad is in the field, and it was just something that I wanted to do. But I had no women role models in my life. I'm from a small town in Newfoundland. So my role model was my dad. I knew of no women architects. And to be honest, that element did not occur to me until I was in architecture school. And that first year, one of my first papers that I had to write as in architecture school architectural history was on women in architecture. And it was like I started seeing architecture with color for a change. I did not know. It didn't occur to me that until then that none of the architects we were researching were women until I saw that there were actually women practicing architects that date right back to Frank Lloyd Wright, Mies van der Rohe, Le Corbusier. In fact, each one of those architects had a woman collaborator. And we didn't learn about these women. And those were the three women that I researched in the paper, Mary Mahoney, Charlotte Perriand, and Lily Reich. You know, no Julia Morgan, no Ellen Gray. I mean, none of these women I had no idea about. So that really impacted how I started to think about the profession. I went to architecture school, started in 1988. When I moved to Buffalo a decade later, I became very active in the AIA. And a woman I met, Adriana Barbash, she was about to retire, but she had been researching Louise Bethune for about a decade, two decades from about the early 80s. The AIA had asked her to do that. And she was about to retire, and she bequeathed to me all of her research. So I immediately began to use the research she had given me, which was, I nominated her to the Western New York Women's Hall of Fame. I've nominated Louise many times to the National Women's Hall of Fame, unsuccessfully thus far. And I started writing articles. And then about a decade or so ago, I started to research her in my own right to write the book that I'm just finishing now, a manuscript on Louise Bethune. Through writing this book that I've understood in a very personal way just how difficult it is to research someone like Louise. And we'll talk about the reasons for that. But it's a much more difficult prospect to research Louise than it is, say, Daniel Burnham, Louise Sullivan, any of the other architects who, had the same time period as her. And part of it was because of how she was treated in the profession, which was with respect, but still she was marginalized. And part of it is her own personal story. So I'll just leave it there right now. But thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Great. We're looking forward to the rest of this conversation as well. I have so many questions already. Why don't we go to you, Lori? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to architecture, and a little bit about your early career?
Sure. Thank you so much for hosting us. I'm delighted to always be in conversation with Despina and Kelly. So I am from Atlanta, Georgia. I had very strong female role models in my family, which I don't know if they would have called themselves feminists, but they definitely were feminists. And there was never anything that I would not be able to do was how I was raised. And I had no idea, similar to Kelly, what architecture was. There were some architects in our kind of larger social, my family's social network, but I'd never had any direct interaction with them. My grandfather was an engineer and had his own construction company. And my dad had followed in his footsteps and was also in construction and management. And so I would go out when I was really young and help him survey sites. And he would help me practice geometry and addition, subtraction, triangulation. So I would go out on these sites with him in the middle of nowhere. And I just thought it was so fun, but it didn't equate to me that this was something you actually could do and what that would mean. And I was also an incredibly creative young girl to young woman. I was always doing art. My mother taught me how to sew. There were always creative outlets. And at some point in high school, I don't know how this equated, but I loved math, I loved science, and I loved art. And so that equaled architecture, which in fact, no, it doesn't, but that was my logic. And so I applied to architecture schools, got in and attended for undergrad the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, where very often I would be the only female in my design studios. I only had one female design professor the entire time of my four-year undergrad. And it was just, that's the way it was. I didn't really think much about that, sadly. My consciousness has been raised since then. But I do recall vividly that the firm Scoggin, Elam & Bray, which is now Scoggin & Elam, is in Atlanta. And they had done a series of projects that some of my classmates and I had gone and tried to visit everyone that we could drive to. And Meryl was teaching in the grad program at Georgia Tech. And so she was like this iconic woman. They were amazing architects and super inspirational, although I'd never spoken to her for a minute. But she was this woman that exemplified, you can do this, you can have a world-renowned career and be a woman. And so that was incredibly inspirational. And I graduated from undergrad right at the 1991 crash. So there were no jobs. I, you know, had to do something else. Got into grad school the year after and went to Princeton. And then there were all these other amazing, strong female role models, both design professors and historians and theoreticians. So it became this environment that demonstrated and illustrated very clearly that there are very successful women out there and that you can be one. And yeah, I remember they made a big deal that my entering class was the first time there was gender parity with the students. And that was pretty remarkable given how small it was. And so I went and practiced in New York and became far more aware that there were so few women in positions of leadership. The women were just as talented as the men, but they weren't being promoted to the same degree in the same way. And I started reaching out to architecture books that were engaging gender and art, gender and architecture. And in the mid-90s, there were actually quite a few. So this became my kind of more broader introduction into women in architecture and the potentials of thinking through a feminist position. And I have to say, one of the turning points is when I went into the academy and became a junior faculty member. And my experience in practice was also mirrored in the academy. There were far few women as professors. There were more female students, but they were not learning enough. They had started talking to me. They were frustrated. They weren't learning enough in any of their courses about women and people of color. So I realized at that point, I could no longer remain empathetic. You know, they were having the same experience I had. And so now that I'm on the other side, I have to change it. I have to do things that will change the trajectory of how students are exposed to much more diverse practitioners and types of practice. And that really kind of set me in a very clear direction and has changed the course of my own life and research. And, you know, I started an exhibition, Feminist Practices. It traveled around the country into Australia. It led to my first edited collection with the same title. It led to co-founding Architects, ARCHITEXX, a women equity organization in New York City, to bridge between the academy and practice. It's been this dynamic, fluid space, and I can tell it is making a difference. and that women, younger women and students are learning more. There's still a lot of work to be done, as I know Smith and Kelly will agree with. And more recently, I'm working on the Global the Bloomsbury Global Encyclopedia of Women in Architecture, 1960 to 2015, with Dr. Karen Burns from the University of Melbourne. And this will be, I think, I'm hoping, a real game changer in the sense that there's over 1,100 women who will be included from all regions around the world. We have prioritized giving space to the Global South and countries that have not had much publication in English. So Africa, the Middle East, Asia. It's due out next year. We've had delays due to COVID, but in 2023, it will be published. And we are incredibly excited about this project. So I will rest for a moment.
Wow. Well, you need it after all that. I feel exhausted and I didn't even go through it. That's incredible. And I can't wait to hear more about your work. So Despina, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to architecture?
So, Talisha, I'm thrilled to be here, and it's a great conversation. I feel like my life is more random. So, I don't know where to start because, you know, when you look back, you can sort of see the lines that pull you into the present. But I think that one of the formative experiences for me early on was my two grandmothers, and they had very different life experiences. They were born and raised in Greece at the turn of the 20th century, a time that was not particularly progressive for women, and they had very different trajectories. One was able to sell her dowry. At the time, Greek women had to have dowries to get married because you had to give men presents. You were so little valued. And so one managed to somehow convince her family to sell her dowry, and she was able to go to school and became a teacher and had a whole career as a teacher. The other was not allowed to go to school at all. And at the age of 6, she started herding goats. And she had 5 brothers, all of whom went to school and went on to illustrious careers. But she never really got over not being able to go to school. And she was illiterate her whole life. And so I had these two very strong grandmothers with very different life trajectories as sort of my first really experience of thinking about women's histories and what is the potential that can flourish and the potential that can be lost. And so eventually this comes to play an important role in thinking about women who want and dream about going into architecture and those who are able to do that and those who are not. And that, you know, these two roads are still with us in some ways, and that there's still so many hurdles that women face. Now, the way that I ended up becoming interested in women in architecture was really by accident. I had just finished a degree in design history from Berkeley. I was back home in Montreal listening to a radio show on the local CBC station, and they were interviewing David Feist, who was professor of design at Concordia University and a former Bauhaus student. So I was listening very intensely because I had, you know, studied the Bauhaus at Berkeley. And, you know, when he was talking about the philosophy of the school, you know, I was nodding along. Yes, yes, yes. This was what I had learned at Berkeley. And then the interview took an interesting turn. And he started to talk about all the great parties that they had had at the Bauhaus and all of the female students that he had danced with. And at that point, I thought, what? You know, who are these women that he's talking about? How have I just finished a master's degree in design history and I've never heard about them? So I went off to the library, and in the early 90s, when this happened, there wasn't much written on women's design histories. And so I confronted the empty shelves, and I went back to graduate school, and I ended up studying the first women to pursue architecture in Germany. And eventually, I taught in architecture schools, and became aware that there were patterns that were continuing that were really disturbing. I had looked at women architects in Germany at the turn of the 20th century, and a century later, I was encountering similar hurdles, listening to my female students and female colleagues. And I began to wonder about what is the connection here through history? What can history teach us? And what is it that we're missing in the sense that we're continuing this cycle so many decades later? So that's sort of my trajectory into this interest in the history of women in architecture.
Well, thank you for letting us know that. That doesn't sound so random to me. It sounds like, you know, there was a clear progression. So I'm looking forward to getting into your story a little bit deeper as well. I want to go back to you, Kelly. You told us a little bit about how you got to researching Louise Bethune, but there were some other women in the field that you at least got to know about. What made you want to specifically study Louise Bethune, besides the fact that you inherited, like, you know, all this research? Like, what was it about Louise, if I can call her Louise?
Please do.
That made you really want to dive in deeper?
Louise and I are on a first name basis. It's a one-sided conversation, but you know, I think I'm learning a lot more about her. I'm getting to know her well. Well, of course, I live in Buffalo. She practiced in Buffalo. She moved to Buffalo when she was 12 years old. So that certainly interested me. And I've always been interested in the first. So from the outset, I was less interested in her buildings. That seemed to be where a lot of people had focused. And I was more interested in her life and how, I mean, answering the questions you're asking of us, like, how did you become who you are? What was that? And that was a much more interesting to me than studying the Renaissance style in which she designed her 1890s, name the building, et cetera. That led me on, you know, a path towards understanding some of the archives and the other spaces around Buffalo, and really trying to put myself in her shoes. And living in Buffalo, I could do that. The other thing is, which I didn't mention earlier, is that my deep passion has always been in educational architecture. So Despina and I worked on an Architect Barbie 10 years ago now. 10 years, Despina, wow. And we were a perfect pair because Despina brought the theory side and the advocacy side of, you know, women and architecture to the project, and I brought the educational piece. I wanted to talk about the doll as a learning opportunity for little girls and, you know, a model in a way, a model as in, you know, figure model. And so what I found out was that Louise also, her true passion was in educational architecture. So over the years, as I've gotten to know Louise better, I'm actually finding a lot more parallels in our lives. And it is not, I don't think, so much that I'm modeling my life on her. It's just that we have very similar interests in the profession. She was very interested in how architecture impacted the human experience, as am I. She was more technically oriented than I am, certainly a better businesswoman than I probably would be if I was in my own practice. But she was very interested in how architecture makes the human experience and how it makes life better. So that to me was very interesting. And so one of the questions that I've been asking myself is her attitude towards women in the profession and just in general, women in society. And there's a long-held belief amongst some scholars, those who have researched her, because they've looked at a very, very narrow one lecture, really. And they take a couple of comments that she made and say she was not a feminist. And I feel very differently based on looking at her larger life, looking at articles written about her, looking at the clubs that she was in, the friends that she had. So I guess the point is I see a lot of myself in her. And so she's really become, maybe not a role model, but Maybe a role model. I mean, she's just certainly become somebody that she's certainly my measuring stick. And I'm just in awe that somebody who was born before the Civil War, before architecture really had a professional status, how it would occur to her that she could become an architect. So, I want some of that strength.
Yeah, sure. Send some my way as well. Because when you think about it and the time period that she was living in, I can complain today, but, I have it so much easier than what she would have had going on in her time. It's amazing to think about how she was able to persevere and get to this point where she can, rightfully have an important place in history.
Right. Yeah. And then we'll talk about this a little more. For a long time, I thought of her as a trailblazer. And unfortunately, I don't think that's the case, only because trailblazers set a trail for others to follow. And there actually is a large gap between her and a significant number of women who followed. There were some women who came shortly after, but they weren't necessarily following Louise. So sadly, she was so early and her story was so unique. I think women, contemporary women today, have a lot more in common with Louise than women who followed shortly after. And it really was not until the 1920s before we started to see significant numbers of women who joined the profession. And this is really delving into Despina and Lori's expertise now. But it took far too long for women to really have a place and not be an asterisk, not be, an other in the profession.
Yeah. And I wonder, maybe this is a nice transition over to you, Lori, and maybe you can be able to answer this. I wonder to that point, if there weren't more women, but they just didn't have as much visibility and maybe as much of that, what we call strength, or, maybe it's courage, maybe it's both, to put themselves out there in a particular way in order to be seen. So I wonder, in between Louise and the second female architect, maybe there were some in between.
Well, I think we have to recognize, and there's the structural barriers that prevented women, continue actually to diminish women's contributions to the discipline. So it's not that women aren't trying or that they're not participating. And I know Despina has written about this, but we have been written out of history for such a long time. And I think the question also is, how do we understand value and contribution to the field when it's not, the myth of the lone star genius, but it's actually architecture is practiced through collaboration. You work with other people, with other disciplines in order to get things built. So it's the structure itself, which has not been created, that allows those who aren't white men to be recognized and promoted and celebrated. So structurally, we still have a lot of work to do in order to promote more diverse types of people practicing in the different diverse types of practices. So I would imagine, and this is not my particular time period, but there have to be women who are finding ways to practice, but they just aren't being acknowledged, or they're in the studio and their names aren't attached to projects and the kind of contributions that they're making. So I think how our contributions are understood, what the values of them are, have to be changed for more voices to be included in the historical record, both past, present, and future.
And is that something that you feel like you're working towards with doing the Bloomsbury Encyclopedia?
Absolutely. And it's funny, well, not funny, but of course the publisher wants all of the known women to be included, because as they said to us, we have to sell it because we want libraries to buy it. But we were, for us, it is a political project because we were insistent that the parameters of inclusion had to expand. So it's not only buildings, it's those who work in historic preservation and government service and teaching and education and curation, pedagogy, critics, architectural critics. There's so many different ways to practice. And when you also combine that with the different social, political, economic situations around the globe, women have had to figure out ways to practice because they may not, for cultural reasons, be able to be so physically present or to be on job sites. So there are cultural constructs that also women have had to navigate, continue to have to navigate and negotiate in order to be a part of the production of the built environment. We refused to accept that it was only about buildings, that we had to expand it in order to demonstrate a much wider inclusion of women and women's contributions.
And in doing your research, and I'm sure reaching out to people working on this and working in all of the other ways that you have in your career so far, is there anything that really shocked you? I'm sure there are many things that surprised you, but didn't shock you, you know?
So we're in the process of going through the editing of the project right now. And one of the things that's been so, I will say, shocking is the amazing ways women have practiced around the world that I had never heard about. And I'll use the former Soviet Union and Russia as an example. So under communism, ostensibly, women had the same equality as men. And so we have women included who were working on leading massive projects, whether that's through the mining industry, transportation, education, housing. I mean, I am talking about, I had never seen the degree in which women were practicing in such monumental ways. And there's been a vacuum of that kind of experience and series of examples in the Western Hemisphere. So, you know, most of our contributors, we have a series of area editors who are experts in those regions. They then create a network of contributors. So it's very much embedded in the expertise of the local regions. And it's astounding and both enraging because, you know, we didn't learn about this, but then super exciting that no one can ever say, I don't know that there are any women practicing like that, because this project is going to show and provide examples and bibliographies of that 1,150 women, it, plus because we figured out a way to get more women's names into it. Why hasn't this happened before?
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing that you're doing it now, right?
For sure. For sure.
It hasn't happened before because you haven't been here before. So, Despina, I want to talk a little bit about your listening to that radio program. And so I just want to clarify. So you did your undergrad at Berkeley?
I did my master's degree at Berkeley.
Okay. And it was after then that you went back for another master's?
No, I was. So I finished my master's degree in design history at Berkeley. And then I went back to Montreal, my hometown, to work. And I was actually working as a curator at the time when I was listening to this interview. So at that point, I had 2 degrees under my belt. And that's why I was so shocked when this David Feist started talking about these women, because I had, I thought, you know, pretty deep background in design history and had read about the Bauhaus, and I just couldn't believe that there was this whole other piece of that history, very significant piece of the history that I hadn't heard about. And it wasn't one or two women. That's the other thing. It was like half the school, right? So that's not a marginal history to leave out. And, you know, all of us, it's interesting, are talking about what we didn't know, and that moment of shock when you kind of realize there is this whole horizon out there that you hadn't seen. And on the one hand, it's very exciting. And on the other hand, it is, as you're also hearing, maddening, because you feel robbed. You feel robbed of a history that you only encountered maybe by chance or through a lot of hard work. And why hasn't this been a part of sort of your education? So I think we've all had that experience. And I think when you work on histories that are not in textbooks, not on the library shelf, and not on syllabi, you have these moments where you realize just how much you don't know.
Right. Yeah. And so with your writing of Where Are the Women Architects, I'm sure that you also explored what was happening in your mind or through your research in the gaps between, you know, like the first and then the next? And where were all the women back in 2016 when you wrote?
Well, they were there. They were, obviously, they were.
You found them.
Practicing, but they were also in history. And that's, you know, what were, one of the things the book explored was the fact that architecture as a profession has confronted this question, asking about why women are not better integrated into the profession or more welcome into the profession. And so I traced the history of that question, and I went back, oh gosh, you know, probably about 150 years when it first starts to pop up, the sort of the 19th century, and people are asking, well, why, you know, why is architecture so resistant to women? And then what I discovered that was so frustrating is that there would be this moment of like enlightenment and discourse, and people would notice this and talk about it. What do we need to change the field? And then they would forget about it. And, you know, 15 years later, it would pop up again. And then again, people would forget about it. So it was this cycle of kind of becoming aware of the diversity issue in architecture and then forgetting about it. And so finally, I wrote the book to sort of ask, well, how long are we going to just keep doing this? And how do we break out of that cycle of noticing the profession, you know, needs to change and then forgetting all about it? And this goes to the structural question that Lori brought up about, and also Kelly, about these women who were pathbreakers. And you know, there's multiple pathbreakers because of the structural impediments in architecture. You know, someone would come along, an exceptional individual, and break the glass ceiling, and then the glass ceiling would reform after that person. So you're having people who have to keep breaking it again and again and again. And this is why we have to pay attention to structural impediments, because no matter how great an individual may be, they can't on their own break a ceiling that will just reform after them.
That's an interesting point that you just brought up, that, you know, that glass ceiling just gets reformed. I mean, what are some ways that you have found, especially since writing the book, that maybe we can start to change that, you know, like put a skylight in at the very least, and then like, what are some ways that we can start to think about having that glass ceiling not become a glass ceiling, but being more of a portal?
I think there's probably not any one solution, but rather multiple solutions. For me as a historian, I am particularly concerned about histories getting written and sort of the bookshelf filling up, so that when people go and they look, they do encounter, you know, information about the past, and they could see themselves there. Because what often happens is when the histories haven't been written, you are told that it doesn't exist. And that was the case with me, that when I first wanted to study the first women architects in Germany at the turn of the 20th century, I was told, oh no, you know, they don't exist that early. They exist much later on. So this is a very common experience when someone wants to study the history of a marginalized history, is that we're told, well, no, it's not marginalized. It doesn't exist. So I think it's very important that those bookshelves fill up. And then as those bookshelves have been filling up over the last few decades, I feel it's very important that we take those books and articles and actually use them in our courses, or use them in intervening in Wikipedia, which Lori knows all about. But that they also have to get activated, those histories, in terms of changing the way that we think about how we ended up here. And that's just the history piece, but there are many other ways that we need to approach this. I think thinking about structural change is key, because that's the thing that didn't change, right? So what does structural change in architecture look like?
Yeah, and if I could just jump on that, what I found interesting in researching Louise and writing her book was how society viewed women and their place and their roles in society and how they could contribute. So, and even though the examples are different, I still think today we still have similar issues. So maybe I'll be a little more specific and it'll become a little more illuminated. During the 1800s, women were viewed within the perspective of like the cult of womanhood, meaning, you know, the woman's place was in the home and she was put on a pedestal almost. It was really expected to be, she was expected to be the caregiver of the home and the family. And that was her realm. And so any woman who tried to break out of that and pursue a profession, it was always viewed within that context of the cult of domesticity, the cult of true womanhood. So if a woman wanted to become, let's say, a physician or a lawyer, it was always within the realm of, well, there's, you need a woman doctor because somebody has to understand women's bodies. You need a woman lawyer because somebody has to, you know, fight for women's and children's rights, et cetera. Educators, of course, was viewed within the prism of the cult of domesticity, you know, an extension. Writers, also an extension. But an architect, people automatically assume, well, then I guess, you know, their expertise should be in residential design, of course, because that's their area, right? And so even now you hear that women innately are better at this type of work than other types of work. And Louise Broke really opposed that idea, and she was focused on the right of a woman to choose a profession, not based on her innate predisposition by her gender, but on her natural skill and interest. And so she really opposed the idea of a woman being pigeonholed as a residential architect and really fought that. So that's one piece that I think even now, if you look at the 20th century and the ebb and flow that women encountered before the war, during each war, and then afterwards, they were constantly pushed back into the home because they had to make way for their male counterparts. The other thing that I'll say is one of the oppositions to women becoming architects was their clothing. And so it was about their physicality because of the fact that what Lori talked about, the science piece of architecture, the building science, but also monitoring construction. And that also, like our whole professional experience and how we present ourselves as professionals goes right back to even to today. I mean, women, how they present themselves is an important aspect of the professions they pursue. So, you know, because women wore skirts and were, you know, confined to petticoats and the corsets, it was considered that they couldn't be an architect. It was impossible. And so that whole idea of a woman can only be viewed within the prism of their gender, I think even though the extremes and the examples are different, it's helpful to learn that because it enables us to look at our own biases and challenge them as well.
Yeah, and I would want to also return to the structural question. So as Kelly mentioned about Louise Bethune and that there was this major gap, and thinking about how do we both individually and collectively create more opportunities for women coming up and through. So it's not just about yourself, but it's also about the future of the discipline looking different and operating differently than it does while we're in it, as well as historically. I've thought a lot about what does it mean to have gender parity, you know, in terms of equity and equality in architectural education, I'll say first. And looking at, you know, our student population is basically 50% male, female. I mean, if we're going to use the gender binary right now. But yet, when you look at who's leading architectural institutions across North America, we have at most a third of women who are either deans or chairs or department heads. And then when you look at our curriculum, it's still incredibly white and male. So at all of these areas, there has to be radical change in order for there to be a different future in the discipline. So I think, you know, all of our different efforts are definitely leading towards what will be curricular change. I think the leadership piece requires institutions to be committed to more gender equitable institutions of education. So that's a leadership piece. And I think in practice, I can't speak specifically to practice, But there's still a very small number of women leading major, larger firms across the country. So at every juncture, there's major drop-offs of women and people of color. And so how do we start to continue to promote at a much larger rate, a more diverse future? And I think it requires that we are committed. I mean, I find the gender quota system that the UN has implemented to be really an interesting model to think about how systemic change can happen. And that when there's a commitment to a gender quota, we'll say in South America, there was a 40% gender quota. All the countries in South America by, I think, the 2000s had massive changes in their representation in government. But that was because there were policies that created it. And I think unless we take more strident efforts, it won't happen in a piecemeal way. There has to be a larger collective concerted commitment to these issues for radical change to happen.
That's an interesting point, because I agree that there has to be that commitment to changing things. But, well, I won't say but, I'll say and. What I sometimes think and sort of feel, especially being a Black woman, you know, within this industry, believe me, I hear everything that you're saying and I'm like, right on, you know, let's keep this going. How do you think that we can start to sort of make these commitments, and organizations, companies, schools, you know, the whole world can start to make these commitments without it feeling like people are just sort of checking off these quotas? Because, you know, like if you have these markers as to whether or not you're doing good or whether you're still in the doghouse when it comes to diversity and inclusion, how do you work that so that it doesn't feel like you're just like, okay, we've got three young women who identify as women in this particular class or, you know, in our organization. So we got it. We're doing great.
Right.
And especially if one of those women is a Black woman, oh, we're excellent. You know, we don't have to do anything more.
I mean, we're not talking about it, but there's the assumption that everything's a meritocracy, and we know that that is just not the case, and that white men reproduce white men, and et cetera, and et cetera. You hire people who look like you, you know, the bias.
Right, sure.
I'll give an example that I looked at many years ago. The law school at Yale, there's an organization called the Yale Law Women, and they were really frustrated with law firms not creating more inclusive policies for graduates. So they started to do this survey of the top 100 law firms to see what kind of policies they have in place for pay equity, for parental and family leave, for promotion to partner, and like what were the structures in place that these firms had that were helping elevate more diverse young lawyers entering into the discipline. And this list has become an attractor, and firms want to get on this list because it means the brightest graduates of their law programs will want to work in these firms. So yes, there is a bit of bean counting, so to speak, but it serves a greater purpose and has created change and shift in law. So I know and this has been said over and over again, oh, well, you know, we have large architecture firms, we have boutique firms, we can't hold everyone to the same parameters. But I think we as a discipline there needs to be larger conversations about the commitment for change, and that it's not performative or it's not checking boxes, but that we want our discipline to reflect the demographics of our world that we are building for. And it doesn't. And we are a long way from it. So I guess I'm more on the side of I'm for policies and I'm for numbers and data that show how we're moving in a more diverse direction. Unless we hold each other accountable, it's just not going to happen, or it won't happen to the degrees in which it needs to happen. And I hear you, and I don't mean to sound unsympathetic because I completely...
I don't think you sound unsympathetic.
But I, you know, there's a frustration here that it's not happening fast enough. It's not going to happen fast enough. Will it happen in my lifetime? Probably not. But it is moving. And I think all of the efforts we're talking about are helping move it. But I think there has to be greater pressure on the profession and education for more significant change to be made.
Yeah. And I think Lori was talking about numbers and a sense of, you know, being able, metrics and being able to measure your progress. Well, before we even have that, we have to have goals. So your school, your company should be setting some goals in terms of thinking about the future that it wants to help create. And, you know, once you have your goals, you have to think about how you're going to implement them, how you're going to hold yourself and others accountable. And in architecture, I mean, I'm not a professional architect, but I'm all for sort of professional organizations and their power. And so just in the field of architectural history, when the NAAB mandated that architecture schools teach not only Western architectural history, but also non-Western architectural history, there was some grumbling. And then guess what happened? Everyone started to teach both. And, you know, the courses got so much better and the students were thrilled. And the faculty dealt with it. And so I think that we have to also hold our professional organizations accountable for pushing forward these changes. And by setting, as you know, Lori is saying, you know, putting policies out there, setting also the expectation that we're going to be setting goals and then that we're going to be working our way toward their implementation.
I give the AIA a lot of credit. I think in the past 10 years, they really have, maybe even the last 5 years, really have leaned into structural changes within the awards they give. For instance, you know, when they changed the gold medal to allow for partnerships, I think that helped, you know, a great deal. And then they are consciously award their firm awards with an eye towards teams. Obviously award-winning work, but the composition of the firm and the philosophies of the firm towards diversity. And again, I think both Despina and Lori make a good point. Diversity in and of itself is perfect, obviously, but explaining the value of diversity to a firm and why it is important, why it isn't about checking boxes. It shouldn't be just about winning work, but it's because the quality of the work is better when you have diverse perspectives, diverse attitudes, a diversity of thinkers and designed thinking that produces the work. And so, you know, I'm a client, you know, we hire firms a lot. And I do get very frustrated when you can very easily tell when a firm is just meeting its MWBE requirements as a checklist, because you never see those firm team members again. In fact, it's one of my greatest pet peeves, and it's really impacting how I am approaching projects, is thinking about the entire team composition. So that is something I think we all need to hold ourselves accountable to. It's not the what, it's the why. Why are we doing this?
I think that that's an interesting point as well. You know, shifting how we're thinking about this, you know, and how organizations and companies and everything are thinking about this. And I kind of am going back to how Kelly and Despina, that you worked on the architect Barbie. I guess some people might feel like, why did you pick Barbie? Because Barbie can sometimes be, you know, wasn't Barbie created as like the sort of perfect 1950s model woman? So why did you pick Barbie as opposed to maybe creating, you know, some other kind of doll or not a doll at all or, you know, something else? But also, I wonder, how do you feel like that, having that Barbie come out for a limited time, how do you feel like it changed maybe some ideas about, you know, that stereotypical perfect woman?
There's a backstory to this.
We'd love to hear it.
Well, first of all, Mattel was the one who started it because they held a competition. So you're right. I mean, and Barbie has been criticized by feminist scholars for her sexist body and, you know, questioning whether she is a good role model for little girls. And Mattel got caught up in that criticism. And in 2001, they responded by creating this series called Barbie I Can Be, which was a career series to try to sort of make her more palatable to parents. The first doll in that series was a baby doctor. That's what she was called, not a pediatrician, a baby doctor. And then they rolled out a competition shortly after to choose the next career for Barbie. And there were three choices: policewoman, architect, and librarian. And I won't go into the whole drama, but there was a really big sort of voting war that broke out because they made the mistake of letting adults vote for it. So librarians really wanted to see the doll become a librarian, and architects wanted Barbie to become an architect. And basically they fought it out. And architect Barbie won. And then Mattel announced that they would not create the doll because she was too complex a career for little girls to understand.
Oh, wow.
Which we can imagine how that went over.
Yeah.
Fast forward to 2006, and I was at the University of Michigan on a fellowship in the School of Architecture. So in 2006, in Michigan, there was a voter referendum that passed that made it much more difficult for schools to consider diversity when they were hiring or creating their student body. In this context, things got very heated at the schools in Michigan, including at the University of Michigan, talking about like what would this law mean for higher education. And so in this context of a very political, heated sort of environment, I was asked to create an exhibition about women in architecture. And I wanted to create something that would get people talking and that would provoke conversation in a way that was, that used humor. And so that would grease the wheels of conversation. And so I thought back to this competition that Mattel had had and the architect Barbie that never was. And so I asked architecture faculty and students to design prototypes for architect Barbie, which they did. And it was a lot of fun, but it actually did get some very serious points of conversation in terms of stereotypes and cultural expectations that are gendered, but also about what architectural education is like. So it was a really productive experiment to sort of try to create these prototypes. And then I forgot all about it. And then Mattel came to Buffalo, met Kelly, and then Mattel ran another one of these competitions with yet again architect being a choice, and yet again architect Barbie lost. So I'll let Kelly continue the story.
So yeah, so that was 2010. Yeah, Desmond has started, engaged a group, and I completely got on board with the vote, and we lost sadly. But after that, I can't remember who approached who, but we decided that we would write Mattel together and just ask if they would consider Barbie as a future I Can Be doll, and you know, stating that one of us is a feminist scholar of architecture history, and the other one is a practicing architect with a background in educational design, especially children's environments, and very active within the AIA, and that we see a need, or the profession is a real need for role models and for opportunities to teach little children about architecture. And that we thought that Architect Barbie would be a great vehicle for that. And so we wrote a letter in April 2010. I remember this oh so well. In May, we received the response acknowledging the letter. And we didn't think about it again until July. And they emailed us and said, actually, we've decided we want to pursue the project. And they asked us to be advisors on it on a confidential basis. So we worked with them for 6 months, you know, reviewing their concepts. And we sent our own ideas, et cetera. And it went from there. I will say that both of us leaned in heavily on the doll because of the fact that she is very much in the realm of a child, a little girl, not all, so some little boys love her as well. But the little girls definitely understand that she is a doll that is made for them. So despite the very real concerns that certain feminists had, especially during the second wave of feminism in the 1960s and 70s, women my generation and later, I'm in my 50s, understand that I have memories of playing with Barbie. And so we understood, and certainly women afterwards understood certainly very well just the impact that the doll can have on your life. So we really enjoyed it a lot. The one thing that I'd like Despina to continue, but the one thing that we really wanted to have, getting back to my earlier comment, we understood that she was not meant to look like what an architect imagines herself looking like. She needed to look like a 7-year-old's version of what she will look like as an architect. So she was not going to wear black. She was not going to wear, a black pantsuit. She was, she was not going to look like what any of us considers, what an architect look like. We needed her to look like a 7-year-old's fantasy of what a grown-up looks like when she goes to a construction site. And wearing a dress was really important to both of us. And in particular, and Despina is the one who taught me this, just the stigma that women, the fight that women had to pursue architecture as a profession because they were confined to wearing a dress in the 1880s and 90s and right up until the 1950s. So, or at least the 1920s. So even though a lot of feminists from that era, from say the 1970s and 80s, really were opposed initially to the project because she was wearing a dress, we felt that it was actually a sign of opposition to embrace the dress, not to, to try to make her look like Zaha Hadid or Deborah Burke or any of these wonderful women architects who I adore. She needed to not look like the architects that we know and admire. She needs to look like the 7-year-old version of that.
And we were also thinking about how do we get a message out? And by that point, Kelly and I had been working on women in architecture for a long time. We really wanted to reach a broader audience, and we realized we had to reach a broader audience if we were going to help to bring about change. And so we had a message, and Mattel had the means to deliver it. We were also, I think, very frustrated with the silence around these issues. That's not to say that there aren't and weren't at the time many women who had been working long and hard to get that message out. But still, on the whole, there was not a lot of discussion around these issues. And, we were confronted by silence. And the discussion that emerged after Architect Barbie launched, sometimes contentious as it was much better than silence, in my opinion. So we also kind of threw ourselves into it without realizing what we were doing. If we're really entirely honest, I don't think we had really fully appreciated the power of Barbie as an icon. We certainly had not, I think, fully absorbed the power of social media. But I think it turned out rather well. And, I grew up in a great family, and, sometimes we communicate in ways that appear to be, people might think, well, you're just yelling at each other, but we're still communicating. And I really do think that's so much better than the void.
The project did, to Despina's point, it inspired a whole series of symposia around the country. Many local AIA chapters held them, and many panelists were stridently against the project. But guess what? If it hadn't been for the doll, there probably would not have been a symposium in that particular city on women in architecture. So it galvanized, people around a topic that had fallen. In 2010, nobody was talking about women in architecture. Nobody was talking, at least in my realm, about the fact that has there been no woman a gold medal? I mean, I remember talking to people about that. It was no longer of interest. It was, I hate to say uncool, but it was not part of the conversation. And, within 3-4 years, It was. There were many reasons for it. I wouldn't say Architect Barbie is the whole sole reason, but it was one reason why it started to become a conversation, you know, within AIA chapters and in firms.
Yeah. And I think to your point, Despina, about it being about the power of social media and all of that, I think that it's a testament to the power of women and, you know, women in architecture and women who believe in other women. And I think that that idea goes to your earlier point about that glass ceiling reforming, you know, after a trailblazer goes through it and it reforms. And I think that this is one of the most powerful, but not necessarily outward or not necessarily out loud way that you can actually, you know, use your positions and use your thoughts in order to sort of keep that glass ceiling broken, or at least keep an opening so that other people can sort of go through afterwards, because it did. It made an impact of having that Architect Barbie, right? And in ways that you didn't think about before.
One thing that I really appreciate about the project is also that it, whether it was intentional or not, it really calls out or challenges the elitism of the discipline, of the profession. And I think if we really want architecture to have the impact it deserves and its contributions to the larger built environment, we have to engage a much broader constituency. And one thing that's so brilliant about Architect Barbie, the Architect Barbie project, is that it does that. And it's through popular culture. And so I think how we educate the broader public about the significance of why the built environment matters, like, this is one mechanism to do that. And I love seeing the images when you have those workshops with the young girls, when you were at the different, I don't know if it was at the different state conventions, but I was just thinking about, in terms of educating and raising awareness for young students about what is an architect, so many people don't know. And that starts them to think about, wow, like, that's something maybe I could be interested in, or just knowing that they exist. Like, it's so powerful as an entry into thinking about who does build our world and what do those people look like, and how do they do it? Like, I just think there are so many brilliant pieces to this project, and it clearly ignited a lot of biases that people have had. I love it. I have one.
So, Lori, I think that that's a good segue into talking a little bit more about architects, which, by the way, one more X and it would have had a totally different connotation. It would have been a totally different thing. But, you know, I sort of feel like you're doing a similar thing in highlighting and bringing to the forefront in a way that, you know, it's not about fireworks, but it's about keeping a fire burning on the topic. Can you talk a little bit about what made you decide to start this?
Sure. So in 2011, my edited book came out, and the end of 2011. In 2012, there was a series in March at the Van Allen Institute of book talks, round tables, actually. I was interested in bringing in the voices who were a part of it. Actually, Despina was involved in one of them. And then others in the city who were women and who were designers and architects. So there was a series of these. And it became so evident that there was such a gap. The AIA has women in architecture. Some architecture schools have women in architecture or women in design, but there's like this gap between the profession and the academy. And we saw this, or I felt literally, that there's a need that needs to be filled. So I didn't know what this would look like. I just started asking if I could take people's contact information, that I'll be back in touch. And through the course of the following year, we would meet every month in the city and have a series of conversations, which led to the co-founding of the organization. So it was very grassroots. It was very much Like, what do you need? What is there? What is missing? How can we amplify some of the important things that are already going on? And so really our efforts have come from those who are wanting to engage and be a part of the work, as well as responding to, you know, contemporary socio-political conditions. And it was so empowering. I mean, it's like, you know, when you look back, it's like, oh yeah, that kind of made sense. But I didn't know what to do except for we have to begin talking and we have to begin meeting, because through those engagements, something's going to come out of this. And we became a 501c3 in 2015. And we've become a bit more project oriented. We now have this traveling exhibition, which actually has been at the University of Buffalo, and it's currently the last venues at the Boston Society of Architecture until the end of September, which is raising awareness of the last 40 plus years of advocacy, activism, and alliances in American architecture. So we see women in architecture as a very large umbrella that all of these efforts fall within, very much committed to raising women's awareness, the awareness of women's contributions, educational, social parts, activist parts, and it's fluid. So we have a mission statement, but we just, after Black Lives Matter, realized that we need to reconfigure ourselves. We need a new board. We need to respond to what is happening right now. So it's been a little bit slower in its evolution given COVID, but we are underway and charting a new future, well, a related but different path in response to all of the things that we became so much more aware of as a result of George Floyd and the amazing civic engagement of Black Lives Matter. I hope personally that it's this dynamic organization that will continue to be able to be responsive, take on issues that the more established organizations may not want to or willing to, because we're independent. We don't really answer to anybody. So we see that as our strength as well. So it's something that's ongoing and a collaboration in its entirety.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And I like the idea that something that is based around women is independent and you don't have to answer to anybody but yourselves.
Thank you.
Well, I think that this is a sort of great way to wrap up our conversation. But before we end it here, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you're all involved in education. So, you know, it's a place where you can shape young women's minds and young men's minds, young people's minds in general, about how they think and how we react and how we interact with women in architecture. So I wanted to sort of ask all of you, what is something that you feel like is important to impart on young people, and especially the young people that you work with in the schools, about the work that you have been doing, the work that you are doing, and about what it means to pay attention to this stuff in the future going forward? What do you feel like you would like to impart on those young people? Kelly?
Several things. First of all, something that I learned continually realizing this is that the profession, it is a lifelong endeavor. And in order to be a good architect, the learning never stops. So my advice is to embrace the fact that it is a profession of lifelong learning. That's the first thing. The second is, even bad architecture takes a team. A good architecture takes an even more diverse team. And that team is composed of not just the designers, not just the building scientist experts, the engineers, but your client, your community, the builders who build it, all of it. So I think that's really important. This notion of a single genius behind a building never existed. And it was always a fallacy, and it is especially that now. And then the third thing that I would say is that there has never been a time quite like now where architects and design thinkers are needed by society. And so this is a plea not just to the future architects, but also to schools, architecture schools, that society needs our talents. And we need to address how we conduct our business. We need to address how we solve problems. And we really need to focus on saving the planet and addressing societal issues. I'm not saying architecture can solve everything, but many of the society's problems should be at least addressed, if not fixed, by the profession and by design.
Thank you for that. Some good wisdom. Laurie, why don't you tell us what you want to leave behind for students or have students go with?
I think that you can make a difference, that your passion can lead you to chart your course. And that if you remain true to that passion, it won't be straight, but it will lead a way. And to become more aware of what fuels you, what brings you joy, where do you see things working for you? I also completely agree with Kelly that the built environment needs to matter more significantly to the world at large for reasons of social justice. And given the extremes that we are finding ourselves in, architecture is so well positioned to be a part of collective action to work on these issues. And I really think the students, this upcoming generations of students, it's going to be on them. We can help, and I definitely am trying to help bring in interdisciplinary ways of working, introducing them to disciplines that we need to become more affiliated with, but that our expertise does matter, and we need to help the broader public understand what it is we do and why it matters, and that collective action is possible and absolutely necessary, and that by working together, voices will change. Voices are power, and that will change things. I mean, look at Black Lives Matter, look at Greta Thunberg, look at all of these women's organizations over the history of the 20th and 21st so far. Voices together will make change. So I want them to understand that they have this, it's a responsibility that I hope they will rise to.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the first point that you mentioned, self-awareness is so important, especially for women to have, because I think that that leads to what you're passionate about and what you feel like you want to lend your voice to, you know. At the core of that is having self-awareness that you do matter. So Despina, why don't you tell us what you give to students and younger people?
Yeah, I would echo Lori's emphasis on collective action, but maybe reframe that around your own life and think about in your own circles. This work of change, of activism, it is hard. And it takes time, and you need that support around you to motivate you, inspire you, and to keep you in the game when things are getting tough. And Kelly and Lori are both part of that community for me. I've been working with both of them on various projects, and I want to correct actually something that Kelly said when she said that we contacted Mattel in April of 2010. It was actually Valentine's Day on 2010, and we were at a cafe surrounded by lovebirds. And then there was Kelly and me working on this letter to Mattel. And I will like always cherish that memory. Lori and I have met at conferences around the world. And you know, those memories are also really important to me. So it's about what it's going to, the fuel that you need as a change agent, the community you need around you to keep you going for the long term, and really think about the long term. Although even as you work on projects now, make sure that you stay strong for the long term. And that takes communities. Find your people, find your community, find your friends.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea of community and building your community and a community that supports you and encourages you, that does what it needs for you, is so important. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is to find your tribe, as they say, although maybe that's not the politically correct thing to say anymore, but to find your community. So thank you for all of that. I know that we're a little bit running out of time or past time now at this point, but I wonder if I can hold you for just a couple more minutes and ask you just a few fun questions, if you don't mind. So I'll start with you, Kelly. Pancakes or waffles?
Pancakes.
Cake or pie?
Oh, pie. Pie. Yeah.
And for extra points, what kind of pie?
Blueberry pie.
Okay. All right. What's your go-to karaoke song?
It shouldn't be. How about Dancing Queen? That's my go-to.
Good one. Excellent. Excellent. Our horoscopes, are they BS or fascinating?
Fascinating, of course. I'm a Gemini, so, you know.
Yeah, that's the right answer, by the way, for Lori and Despina. I'm just kidding. Pineapple or no pineapple on your pizza?
Oh, no pineapple.
No. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Yeah, the hot dog is taboo. I haven't eaten the hot dog since I was 18, so I'm a hamburger girl.
You'll get to it. Okay, last one. Pecan or pecan?
Pecan.
Okay. Lori, your turn. Come on. We got some hungry people.
All right. All right.
So pancakes or waffles?
Waffles.
Cake or pie?
Oh, I'll say pie.
What kind for extra credit?
Pecan.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
Work It by Missy Elliott.
Oh, okay. All right. I like it. Horoscopes, BS or fascinating?
Fascinating. I'm a Pisces.
Pineapple or no pineapple on your pizza?
No pineapple. Mm-mm.
No pineapple. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Absolutely not.
Okay. And we already know what you choose between pecan and pecan. So, thank you. Thank you for playing.
Thank you.
Okay. Despina. The quicker you answer, the quicker you get to dinner. Pancakes or waffles?
Yes, please.
Cake or pie?
Tough one. Chocolate hazelnut pie.
Oh, okay. All right. That sounds delicious, actually. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Mm-hmm. A classic. Yes. Horoscopes, BS or fascinating?
Don't have time for them. Sorry. I'm sure there may be a little bit of both.
Okay. Pineapple or no pineapple on your pizza?
Why not? Pineapple.
Okay. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
It's delicious, so I'll eat it.
Pecan or pecan?
Pecan.
Okay. All right. Well, I love it. Thank you so much to all three of you, Kelly, Lori, Despina. It's been an amazing conversation, and I hope that all of your projects continue to grow and flourish and become popular culture. And as I recently said, I hope that we can start normalizing these sorts of conversations so that we're not necessarily labeled as a female architect, or, you know, you're just an architect, and no matter what you look like, it won't come as a surprise to people that you do this. So thank you for all the great work that you do. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure that our listeners are really appreciative of all the good things that you have put forth into the world. So it's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It's lovely.
Thank you.